say as a very brief introduction that I started to study this topic thanks to a Czech philosopher, not casually, which is not Jan Paduska, but another one whose name is Karel Košík, who during the 60s and the 70s wrote many things about the idea of laughter, and it's also the end of the part of the stoke. So the last part was explicitly quoted in this philosopher trying to see what they actually say. But before I would like to try to make a sort of a history of this idea, philosophical history of laughter. And I would like to start from the title of the talk, actually, that I really like. And I have to thank Mike, actually, who suggested it. At the beginning I was thinking to call the talk The Laughing Subject, which is maybe not so clear as this one. And I like this, the subject of laughter, maybe because of its ambiguity, actually. It's a very ambiguous title, I think. And yeah, it's ambiguous because of the meaning of subject in this phrase. Here, subject is, first of all, the matter, the theme that we are going to discuss, of course, the subject of laughter. Secondly, it is also the main character of the essence here described, the subject that laughs, the so-called homo ridens in Latin. Furthermore, it can also be understood as the victim, the passive character, who is the subject to laughter, the homo ridiculus. There is this sort of parallelism between the two things, homo ridens as the one who laughs, and the homo ridiculus as the one who someone else laughs at. So I think it's important to underline the ambiguity of this phrase, because it's not just the phrase to be ambiguous, but the idea, the concept itself of laughter. And we're going to discuss exactly this ambiguity in this talk, trying to understand its meaning and itself. So the same ambiguity concerns the laughter itself, as I say, and maybe this is the reason why this human phenomenon became an important topic within philosophy. Actually, many philosophers, as we're going to say, spoke, dealt with laughter directly. And this is true actually since the beginning of Western thought. The tradition commonly depicts Heraclitus in the act of crying and Democritus in the act of laughing. There is a contradiction between the two great ancient Greek philosophers. This contrast is described, for example, by a Greek writer from the 7th century after Christ, Lucian of Samosata, in one of his dialogues, whose title was Philosophy for Sale. In this dialogue, Hermes and Zeus, the two Greek gods, try to sell different kinds of philosophy to a nameless buyer who carefully questions the main representatives of the various ways of thought in order to understand which is the best one, so to make a good choice. The moment comes when Heraclitus and Democritus enter the dialogue. This is, of course, all the imagination of this writer. It comes to light, though, that the reason why Heraclitus always cries is the same reason why Democritus cannot stop laughing. They both realize the necessary becoming of the world and, at the same time, the related futility of human activity in front of this necessity. The intuition has also the same effect. Both the philosophers, realizing this circumstance, take a step back from their lives. This is a very important point that I'm going to stress a lot during all the talk. They are no more like common people who act and operate within the world, aiming to change it somehow. Both the philosophers gain a total different chance toward the world. The difference is that Heraclitus feels the pain of this situation, in which all becomes trivial, in which the same difference between good and evil loses its sense. On the contrary, Democritus' reaction to this human condition consists in a burst of laughter. If the world is just a casual dance of atoms, and there is nothing we can do to change the situation, everything loses its importance and therefore becomes laughable. That's also a possible conclusion of this reasoning. This can be actually seen as a cynical attitude. On the other hand, it is also a very human reaction to what is bad in our lives, just laughing. Sometimes when a man or a woman has a tough time, a big laughter can be, of course, really liberating. I think it's an experience that everyone has sometimes. Not just taking a distance from reality can also be dangerous, can also hide the danger. Laughing at everything with no distinction between what is right and what is wrong, between what is comic and what is tragic, is a sign of idiocy, or even of madness. This is actually the way in which Democritus is described by another writer, an anonymous writer, known as a pseudo-Hippocrates. He signs his works as Hippocrates, but actually that's not the real Hippocrates in the city before Christ. It's apparently a writer in the first century after Christ, so another time, not too far actually from Lucian that we saw before. So this pseudo-Hippocrates wrote this imaginary correspondence of the Greek physician Hippocrates with his contemporary, and we have to note that Hippocrates was actually a contemporary of Democritus itself. They both lived more or less in the same period. I think they were born in the same year exactly, which is 460 before Christ, if I'm not wrong, but I have to see that. Anyway, in some of these letters, the inhabitants of the Greek city of Abdera address Hippocrates looking for help after their fellow citizen Democritus apparently become unhinged because they cannot stop laughing even in front of the worst tragedies of life. So they write this letter to Hippocrates asking for help. Nevertheless, when Hippocrates decides to pay a visit to Democritus in order to understand the nature of his illness, the philosopher seems all but crazy and promptly explains what he laughs at. Just a thing, I really hate PowerPoint, so I use it just for quotations and for images. So I'm not making little schemes and things. So that's a very brief and small quotations, just to be more understandable. So what Democritus laughs at, according to this writer? At the vanities and fopperies of the time, to see men's so empty of all virtuous actions, to hunt so far after God, having no end or ambition, to take such infinite pains for little glory, and to be favored of men. And now methinks, O most worthy Hippocrates, you should not reprehend my laughing, perceiving so many fooleries in men. For no man will mock his own folly, but that which he sees in a second. And so they justly mock one another. The drunkard calls him a glutton, whom he calls to be a sober. Many men of the sea, others husbandry. Briefly, they cannot agree in their own traits and professions, much less in their lives and actions. This is the last letter of this corpus. In front of the sight of a man who commits himself to restless activities, absolutely sure of the goodness of his behaving, unaware of the futility of his whole life, the philosopher laughs. That's what happens. This ironic detachment allows him to break the vicious cycle that rules the world, in which the evil is done in order to reach the good, following a sort of automatic rational structure. All these facts tell us two interesting aspects of laughing that, as we are going to see, concern essentially this phenomenon. Firstly, the difficulty to define what laughter actually is, to discover its origin. The same situation, in fact, can cause both laughter and crying. This is the fact. It just depends on perspective, the perspective from which we see this phenomenon. Secondly, the existential movement associated with laughter, namely a step back from reality. This is the second feature of laughter. When we laugh at something, we distance ourselves from it. We are interrupt its import and its effect on us. It is like breaking a spell, in some way. Finding the reduced aspect of a thing or a situation means to neutralize its power on our system. In this sense, Democritus seems to teach us the lesson of self-defense against the harshness of life. Several philosophers try to manifest this liberating feature of Democritus' laughter. Seneca, the late great Latin philosopher, for example, depicted the behavior of the Greek philosopher as a form of wisdom, so appreciating it. The capacity to laugh as the reality allows man to lighten his existence and to achieve a sort of tranquility that is typical of the wise man. This conception spread within the Renaissance, together with the classical iconography of the laughing Democritus. That became a classical topic for artists until the 17th century, more or less. We can see several examples. This is a fresco from Antonio Bramante, an Italian art form. And we can see here Herakles on the left and Democritus on the right. They both look at the same thing, the world, from a very strange and unnatural, unnatural perspective, of course. So, from the outside, no one could never see that in reality. So, what is interesting is that the reaction is just the opposite. Herakles cries and Democritus laughs, despite the ridiculous haircut. So we see this parallelism as the two faces, the real ambiguity of this phenomenon. And this is an example, or again, this is Rubens, he's Democritus, again, laughing, and again, the globe. So again, this step back from reality, and this laughing at it. And this is José Ponce de Libera, also known as Spagnoletto. And again, this Democritus, who here seems like this lunatic guy, who didn't realize that his clothes is broken. So also this sort of detachment as a sort of indifference also towards the common usual life. Or there's something else? Yeah, Velázquez, again. And again, the symbol of the globe as the reality that is just far from the Latin subject. Rembrandt, Democritus, and also a self-portrait in this case. So also a kind of identification with the Latin subject. Yeah, so Democritus is often drawn, as we see at the site, a war globe as a metaphor of this of his detachment. Michel de Montaigne, dealing with the Greek philosopher in his essays, expressed the same vision of Africa. Even with a stronger emphasis. We can see here a quotation. I'm clearly for the first humor, the one of Democritus. Not because it is more pleasant to laugh than to weep, but because it expresses more contempt and condemnation than the other. And I think we can never be despised according to our full desert. Compassion and bewailing seem to imply some esteem and esteem of and value for the thing the moment, whereas the things the last act are by that expressed to be of no moment. This is chapter 50 of the essay by Montaigne called Of Democritus and Philosophus. Here becomes visible from this quotation of Montaigne a further peculiarity of laughter. The detached irony that it implies is not only a way to step back from the world, but also a way to expose the ridiculous aspects of the world. And there are actually another iconography, quite close to the first one, but with another element, if we notice. This is Johannes Movens, the Dutch painter from the same age, more or less, as the previous one. But here we see a totally different laugh. So there is again the globe, there is again the lasting Democritus, but in this case this is an evil laughter, not the indifference, the very tranquil and funny and relaxed laughter before. Now we see an evil laughter towards the world, a sort of mocking. And this is another aspect of this phenomenon. The Latin subject is not peacefully indifferent towards the triviality of the world, is rather scornful towards it. The laughter becomes a sign of disdain, an attack against the world, an action which is therefore provided with a specific power. And this is another element that I would like to stress in this story. The fact that laughter has a specific power that we are going to understand, that we are going to study, to see which shape this power can take. This power of laughter has been often seen as a threat. The origin of the satire can be probably detected in this particular feature, in the capacity of the laughing subject to move a harsh attack against the status quo. In front of this danger, the establishment always tries to react, suppressing the laughter, or at least pushing it out of the political field. A typical case of this phenomenon is, for example, the fool, depicted by Shakespeare in his King Lear. Being the only character provided with a clear view of the situation, the fool cannot avoid to laugh at it, showing its ridiculous aspect. But he is allowed to do that only because he is considered as a loon, and therefore no one pays attention to what he says. This is a typical defense mechanism realized by establishment, so stressing the madness that, as you pointed out, is inhuman to laughter, in order to reject it from the public sphere, diffusing its shattering power. Also within philosophy, there have been many attempts to contain and delimit such a thorny phenomenon. Aristotle, for example, dealing with comedy, has stated that ludicrous is a mere subdivision of the ugly, for example. Moreover, within the medieval tradition, laughter has been often connected to sin. On the other hand, especially within the literary context, several attempts to preserve laughter and its original power can be also found. François Rabelais, in order to define the critics of his masterpiece, Gargantua and Pantagruel, coined the word, strange but a very nice word, which is agelast, which literally means someone who cannot read. This is a Greek root, apparently. Meaning with this term, a person who, being incapable of laughing, takes all too seriously. Another writer, many centuries later, Milan Kundera, the Czech writer, in his The Art of Novel, particularly stressed the importance of this figure, of this agelast, within literature, but also philosophy, I think. Here is a quotation by Kundera's work. Yeah, this is another example of evil laughter, apparently more than the real life of this subject. The agelasters are convinced that the truth is obvious, that all men necessarily think the same thing, and that they themselves are exactly what they think they are. But it is precisely in losing the certainty of truth and the unanimous agreement of others that man becomes an individual. So, we are starting to introduce also some philosophical concepts that could be useful to develop our reasoning. With regard to philosophy, we have to wait until the 20th century in order to find a close examination and a revaluation of the idea of laughter. In this light, the work by Henri Bergson on this subject deserves high esteem, I think. Bergson dedicated a study on the idea of laughter. Now, there's not enough time here to make an in-depth analysis of Bergson's text, of course, so I will limit myself to point out how Bergson's description of laughter can constitute a further development of the path followed until now. According to the French philosopher, there are three basic aspects that characterize this leading phenomenon. Firstly, laughter is something exclusively human. Only a man or a woman can laugh, and likewise only a human being can be the cause of a burst of laughter. A landscape, for example, can kindle feelings like happiness, sadness, or surprise, but it can never be comic, for example. A comic landscape is sort of strange. Second aspect, laughter is usually accompanied by an absence of feeling in front of what we laugh at. we build up a sort of indifference in front of this phenomenon. An indifference that prevents us to sympathize with the object of our laughing. This is according to the sound, this is maybe less evident as method, but it has a sense. This is, according to Bergson, a necessary condition for the outbreak of the comic scene. A sort of a momentary anesthesia of the earth. This is what Bergson is actually saying. Here I would point out, as a symptom equally worthy of notice, the absence of feeling which usually accompanies laughter. It seems as though the comic could not produce its disturbing effect unless it felt, so to say, on the surface of a soul that is thoroughly calm and unruffled. Indifference is its natural environment. For laughter has no greater thought than emotion. To produce the whole of its effect, then the comic demands something like a momentary anesthesia of the earth. Its appeal is to intelligence, pure and simple. So, in front of someone who sleeps, just to better understand this point, in front of someone who sleeps on a banana skin, we instinctively laugh. Just in a second time, we can envision the pain and the embarrassment that an unfortunate person has to feel. First and foremost, are we inclined to laugh at him, at his mishap, stepping aside from his personal perspective, becoming mere spectators of what we look at, with no intimate participation, which is what laughter can cause. This is the same movement we already encountered framing the nature of the laughing subject, a fundamental tendency to take a distance from reality. Now step aside, this is again Bergson, now step aside, look upon life as a disinterested spectator. Many drama will turn into comedy. Here we meet again the laughter of Democritus that prevails over Heraclitus' weeping. And here again we find the fool that laughs at the world, exposing its comic nature through this distance, through this movement of difference that he makes. This attitude can be very cruel, of course. A strange medley between indifference, cynicism, and insanity. From this perspective, it seems that the laughing subject repels his own world, preferring to mock it instead of taking place in it, despite its deficiencies. Apparently, we are in front of a lonely subject whose biting irony prevents him to put himself in someone else's shoes. Here comes, however, the third actor of laughter, which, as you can see, is destined to call everything into question. According to Bergson, laughter, in order to preserve its strength, must be communal. It needs a space of sharing. There is a big difference when someone laughs by himself in front of a funny scene and when the laughter is shared by a community, by a group of people. Just in this last circumstance, laughter is able to expand, becoming contagious. This seems to be the authentic sphere of this phenomenon. Laughter is essentially a social activity, according to Bergson. To understand laughter, we must put it back into its natural environment, which is society, and above all, must we determine the utility of its function, which is a social one. I think I also wrote it. Yeah. This is again Bergson talking. This feature was noticed also by Freud, more or less in the same period, the first decades of the 20th century, in his work about the joke. In this work, Freud focuses his attention on the same social nature of laughter, which is for him as well very important. It's very hard to go going back every time.
My body.
Okay, why is it then that I do not laugh at a joke on my own? And what part is played in this by the other person? In the case of the comic, two persons are in general concern. Besides myself, the person in whom I find something comic. If inanimate things seem to be comic, that is on account of a personification which is not a rare occurrence in our ideational life. Once again, we see here the ambiguous character of the laughing subject. And actually here, not just an ambiguity, but even a contradiction, I think, can be easily detected. How can the subject be apart from the world and at the same time become an active member of the living community? The position of the individual seems to entail this strange situation, which is simultaneously inclusive and exclusive. The contradictions here specified become even deeper in our Kant analysis, considering that it concerns not only the homo ridens, the man who laughs, but also the homo ridiculus, the man to whom we laugh at. According to the French philosopher, what characterizes someone as ridiculous is a kind of mechanical inelasticity, he says. This is actually one point that was harshly criticized about Bergson's work. The fact that he tries to understand the idea of ridiculous in a kind of sort of physiology, so just to find some physiological roots of the fact that someone is fun. But actually, in this case, it can have a good point. So, it is a mechanical inelasticity of the ridiculous subject, a sort of clumsiness that impedes him to follow the pace of the surrounding world. The comic character constitutes, therefore, a little paralysis in the mechanism of the universe, a hindrance that threatens to obstruct the entire system, like a grain of sand that falls in the gear wheel of a device. Nonetheless, the subject is still a part of the system. Sometimes he even struggles to fold the reason, totally unaware of this thorny position he has. The comic person, Bergson is speaking again, is unconscious. As though wearing the ring of Vegas with reverse effect, he becomes invisible to himself while remaining visible to all the world. Nonetheless, the more he tries to adapt himself to the world he belongs, the more the rift between the surrounding reality and him increases, the more the comic effect becomes unstoppable. The scene of the factory in Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times is the perfect example of this phenomenon. During the entire scene, the real trans never stops to repeat the same mechanical movement that his alienating job requires. If you remember the scene, Chaplin always does this for the entire scene. It's a very simple mechanical movement, which is perfectly within the structure of the factory in which he's working. But he never realizes that from a certain moment on, this movement acquires a totally different meaning, which is a comic one. Because this movement, although all his attempts, is no more a part of the system. And right because it is common. Another typical element within the scene is the all-present antagonist who strives to stop the comic character, bringing the situation back to normality. This effort represents the reaction of the establishment, which cannot bear any element that diverts from the mainstream. It is not the case that this kind of character within dumb movies or slapstick comedies, like the ones by Charlie Chaplin or also Buster Keaton, this character, this antagonist, is often depicted as a policeman or as a superior, a figure of chief. They are all faces of a sort of authority that laughter threatens to shake. All their tribes are, however, vain. The comic is too strong to be subdued. Anytime someone tries to border it, its orgiastic power extends. And the movie by Chaplin is quite a good explanation of this point. As light as what emerges until now, a peculiarity of the laughter becomes central. Rather, it's namely, its intrinsic political power. So not just a power in a general sense, but a power that seems to have a political content. In order to better explain this point, it will be useful, as I anticipated before, to recollect the work of a Czech philosopher, who is Karel Kostík, who over the 60s also tackled the same problematic. This is the only exception on my from my quotation rule. Just because probably philosopher is not as known as the other I mentioned before. This is a very, very basic information about the works that could be translated into English. So, Kotick was a Marxist dissident philosopher who also, and also one of the main promoters of the Prague Spring in 1968. Because of his political commitment, he was persecuted by the Czechoslovak regime. For a decade, he was totally isolated, with no possibility to make public speeches or to teach at university. And his work was fiercely banned. In front of this harsh situation, Kotick struggled to define a new philosophical practice, which was able to confront what he called the big mechanism, meaning with it the social and political paralysis structures that characterize the present time. One of the forms that this practice takes for him is exactly the laughter and the humor which is able to arouse it. Here more than ever, this human activity seems to acquire an explicit political resonance. Kotick particularly focused his attention on laughter in a paper he wrote in 1969 called On Laughter. This is a paper wrote on the occasion of a discussion about the topic laughter and liberation. This is also a good parallelism between the two concepts, I think. A discussion that took place in the editorial office of Klammen, a monthly journal of literature and culture in which the main dissident philosophers gathered together during the 60s and the 70s in Czechoslovakia. At the time of the discussion, the situation was particularly hard. The Prague Spring had just tragically ended, and a new season of political repression known as normalization was about to start. A period that ended just in 1989, actually. The fact that Kotick in this particular time decided to deal with laughter reveals the importance he attributed to this subject. In his essay, Kotick argues that whoever listens carefully to speech will hear her laughter. This is the quotation I put in the first page of the presentation. This is the result of a complex reasoning Kotick makes, whose premise is the fundamental relationship existing between speech act and laughter act. Only a being gifted with language, in fact, no, this is after, so no problem. Only a being gifted with language, in fact, is also able to laugh, he says. And speech and laughter are not appendages to human existence, but are in its constituent parts. Laughter is not a real reaction to an external stimulus. It is rather a human practice, comparable to speaking and thinking. Nonetheless, laughter presents a unique feature. It is the fact thanks to which the human being can temporarily dissolve all the bonds that fasten him to the present, relieving from concern and accepting a different level in which all the rules of common existence are overturned. As a consequence, who laughs, according to Kotick, is able to gain a kind of receptivity, a multiplied witness of mind, Kotick says, that enables him to erupt somehow from the structure of daily life. Moreover, in order to reach laughter, a greater synthetic capacity is required. The essence of humor consists of its sense of timing, in fact, of its ability to develop a concise and instant language, able to suddenly hit its target, causing a burst of laughter. Seen from this perspective, first, laughter discovers itself pulled apart from any kind of bureaucratic language, which is based on lengthy and empty formulas. Laughter becomes, in this way, the polemic counterpart against the new speech imposed by normalization. Beyond his general remarks about its nature, there is something else that makes laughter an object of research for philosophers. Once again, we're dealing with the inner contradiction of this phenomenon. Laughing and smiling means taking a distance Nonetheless, the aggregating power of laughter must be acknowledged as well. Kosick particularly stresses this point. Not only laughter as a generic collective function, but it also allows to strengthen a deep bond between people, whose essence is so partly identifiable. As Bergson already pointed out, however spontaneous it seems, this is Bergson again, laughter always implies a kind of secret freemasonry, or even complicity with other laughter, real or imaginary. Here is the contradiction again. Going from an experience that separates, that interrupts the natural links among people, and that at the same time connects them, but on a different level. This communal aspect is precisely what draws Kosick's attention. And now there is the conclusion. In this laughter is born a society of people who acknowledge each other, who do not laugh at each other, but laugh together at their own ridiculousness, as their ability to make others laugh and to evoke a storm of laughter. Pursuing laughter becomes in this way an opportunity to found a new kind of community, able to engender itself in an utterly spontaneous way, without the interference of outer forces. Here, the political power of laughter becomes fully visible. Dealing with the subject and speaking about the political power of laughter does not limit himself to general considerations. On the contrary, he has something clear in mind. Recollecting Thomas Carlyle's description of the French Revolution, which began with the bursts of laughter addressed by the Parisian crowd to the king, the philosopher shows that also the people of France in the spring of 1968 bid farewell to the old order with laughter. This is what could be said. The protagonists of those days were indeed the young people who took the floor in the public debate, using humor and jokes as devices useful to spread the feeling of newfound freedom that characterized that period. On that occasion, laughter really became a political tool. Surely powerful, sometimes also misleading. This joyful laughter, in fact, was hiding a darker and deeper one, namely the laughter of the defeated establishment that was already planning its revenge. The ridiculous regime gives away, but does not give up, and history acts like a hidden encounter between the public laughter of people and the hidden grimness of those who are retreating. But to dream of revenge, of returning to a time when the laughter of the laughing crowd would go away. And here again, once again, this ambiguous character. Laughter but also grief, good but also evil character. Despite this pessimistic remark related to the failed expectations of Kosick and its entire generation, it is necessary to analyze the nature of laughter beyond the historical vicissitudes in order to detect the political element still active in it, even during a period of normalization. The question is then what characterized the laughing crowd of the Prague Spring. By means of the burst of laughter, this group of people proved they were not just a crowd, but rather a community of individuals. This is the best possible answer to the establishment effort to change people in a uniform mass, violently excluding from it any heterogeneous element that could create a disturbance. So this idea of mass is here opposed a different kind of community that identifies its aggregating element in its capacity to laugh, that is, in its most irreducible and heterogeneous element. And this is quite a harsh statement, because normally community is founded on something that is shared, that is easily and commonly shared. And in this case, what Kosick tries to imagine is a community based on something totally another, totally other from it. So, on an element of difference, of heterogeneity, of difficulty, of ambiguity itself. So, a community that acquires a totally different character from the typical idea, the traditional idea we have of it. Kosick shows in this way that the same ambiguity and elusiveness of laughter can acquire a positive value if used within a political sphere, appraising and not refusing this shattering power. Kosciuszko wrote this paper on 1969, as I told you before. At that time, he did not have any chance to publish it. Even the drafts written during the discussion at Plamen were confiscated in 1972 by the agents of the state security during a search in Kosciuszko's house. It's funny because Kosciuszko himself wanted to explain what happened and wrote it as an introduction of this statement that was finally published. And remembering that search that day, Kosciuszko wrote, when asked if the regime was afraid of laughter, the commander of the assault team laughed. And then entered the sheaf of the stenograph material entitled Laughter and Liberation into the log of confiscated material as item number A27. So, another example of this movement of the establishment to take laughter and give it a name, in this case A27. Kosciuszko tried again to publish this article in 1991, after the Velvet Revolution. Ironically, the journal to which he submitted the paper answered negatively. It did not grow out, the paper, it did not grow out of the spirit of the time, they say. And once again, even in a democratic environment, it seems hard, actually, to accept laughter and the possibility open, and also the sense for the community of laughing culture. And I think this makes it is problematic, very contemporary for us all. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Francesco. That was really interesting. I love the artworks as well. You're making a political point, but you're also, I think, making a kind of metaphysical point. And I just wondered if I could push the latter point. I've been trying to read Bergson recently, and I read the essay that you referred to. And as I understand, one of the things he's doing there is to say that laughter somehow initiates a break in mechanical causal patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's using it as an illustration of his own thesis about ontology. Because laughter, you can't make sense of laughter in some way in the tradition that he's partially critiquing. And I wondered that seemed to fit with something that I hadn't thought of, but that seemed to fit with your characterization of as Democritus, the mechanical one, as the one who's constantly laughing at himself, laughing at his own philosophical system. And I just wondered, is that something that you think, I'm not sure how that connects with the political point, because you're making a political point that laughter can actually initiate a break in a political system. A laughing collective can initiate a break in a political system. Do you think the two things are connected, or are they separate?
I think so, absolutely. I'm not sure that Bergson himself would agree, actually. It is funny the way in which Bergson handled the subject, because sometimes he stated that he decided to write just a little book about laughter because he didn't consider it a really ontological and metaphysical subject. So he wanted somehow to distinguish it from bigger problems that, according to him, were more important, apparently. So I don't know if actually he could consider this mechanical element of laughing also as an ontological feature as well. But on my own, yeah, absolutely. I think that this break, this sort of rift that laughter creates within reality is, first of all, an ontological, also metaphysical element that should be studied as it. But I try to underline more political philosophical point of view this kind of ontological rift can actually cause, can actually provoke. Yeah, but that's absolutely a development that it's worth to follow, absolutely.
There is a very interesting page at the beginning of Dr. Tivago by Pasternak, when the revolution starts, and the moment when the crowd turns against an officer is when he does something funny, and they laugh at him, and then they may kill him, and this is where his authority as an aura will disappear. We have a comment rather than a question, and it is about I see that you are interested in the subject of Vata, and starting from the Vata stock in Lucian of Samsara. And I'm absolutely sure that you will find very interesting material in the medieval Vata. Because it goes far beyond the shape. And I explain you why. Because when you link laughter and sin, when in fact it is Umberto Eco speaking in the name of the road, and when the very bad character says that. Laughter kills fear, and without fear you do not have faith. But the problem is that in medieval times we will come across laughter in various forms. For instance, they had an obsession about farming. Foucault was one of the most asked questions, and you have a trait in comic in library in Rome. One of the titles is the art of honesty, honesty, pedantry. This is the way gentlemen talk. But you used at the very beginning of your paper two Latin expressions, which as a fact we do not find in medieval times, the equals and freedom. But what we find is redeeming. And ridiculous is what? The process of man. That is, only man can laugh. And the crafting is this peculiar feature which defines what a man is phonological and ontological point of view very important. For instance, if it is a man, it can laugh. And if it can love, it is a man. And so they asked, for instance, in their commentary on Lucius and on Porphyrius, what makes man so special? And it is the fact that he can love. And then they defined what laughter is, and why it is human to love, and some of them. And that some will do may be less act. And I'm sure you know there's a lot about that. And there is a Clapton, CLASTM, published in 2010 an interesting book, and it is Laughter in the Middle Ages. And then the epistemology of the fundamental human behavior. You have some 900 pages about laughter.
No, but thank you. That's absolutely good to deepen this point. Absolutely, I had no time to focus on the medieval times, and you're right. Of course, there are also these elements in the medieval tradition. It is also true, you quoted Umberto Eco, but but like on his own always quotes things.
Yeah, but
and he was quoting the rule of St. Benedict.
But
in that
case. Forget about the second book of Poetics, because it is a modern invention. No,
I'm not referring to the second book of Poetics. I'm referring to the rule of St. Benedict.
Ah, yes.
That's very clearly very.
But they have not said.
Easily says that Lazarus is connected to the
same. For the same reason, they cannot speak. In other rules, you have the interdiction to speak to cool. Why?
Yes.
Because it leads to.
That's because man is reasonable, is risible somehow. When he speaks, somehow there is the risk he laughs as well, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, just wanted to point one of the main features of the complex era, of course, and it would be very interesting to see, to analyze also this element within your tradition. I really like that you every time there is a seminar you quote a novel. Last time was Bouvard de Piquet, Dr. Givano. I laugh. Really.
Yeah.
Actually, there is. I also can quote a novel. Actually, it's closer to my paper, but that is also close to Givano as well. Cossica, I didn't have the time to quote that, but wrote also other essays, other articles about laughter. And in other articles, he focused his attention on Jaroslav Hašek's The Good Soldier's Fake, of course. That's one of the most important topics for Kosica. And Kosica, in many ways, underlined how actually this soldier's fake, for whom doesn't know, this is a very big and unfinished novel by his Czech-born. And the main character is a soldier during the First World War who fought for the Austrian Empire. And he's all about the typical soldier. He always tries to do what he has to do, but the result of all his actions is ridiculous. Is somehow the same that we also saw speaking about slapstick or something like that. There is a quotation Kosica always makes. Because at one point the character Shvek is in a hospital because everyone thinks that he's mad, and again also the element of madness is in laughter. And the other character, which represents the establishment, wants to speak. He's really mad and tells him, "So make 5 steps," and he makes 15 steps. So the doctor says, "Well, I say 5," and he answers, "Well, you didn't know it." Because actually there is an incapacity to follow the pace of the surrounding world. And because of this fact, Shvek is the most ridiculous character you can ever imagine. This is a very... So I think it's not so far from the quotation of from Pasternak, actually. And that could be also a good way to deepen this point.
And yeah, speaking of which, it's a very, very... amusing chapter in Stadium, Voyage Boudin, about hospitals and laughter. So. And if you don't want to talk about the First World War,
yeah, I'm just going to share it for you, Francesco. Larry, is it okay if we move to some other people, as Mike and maybe some of you have questions as well. Was it Mike? You had a question.
I was so enthralled by the talk. I didn't really have a chance to sort of formulate a question properly. But obviously, you talked about the sort of physical side of laughter and then the metaphysical side that you mentioned. And I was, like you say, I don't know if you agree with Ferguson about laughter not being emotional. I can see why. Said not to be emotional, but I was wondering how you maybe think about the idea about the laughing Buddha, and whether this is
But tell me an example to explain with the lack of feelings and ignorance of laughter. And he says, let's try to imagine a comic novel and a tragic novel. For example, let's think about Shakespeare, not novels or pieces or any kind. So let's think about Shakespeare's Othello, author, for example. That's a story of a jealous man. But no one could ever imagine to change the title from author to the jealous. It's quite strange. It doesn't fit. But it's not strange that Molière gets about Arpagon is called the Avar. So there is something interesting in this point. So we don't have problems to take a distance from the character if it is a comic character, calling it not with his name but also with only with his function. That actually doesn't want to pay attention. But we cannot take this distance from a trash character, like author. We cannot accept to call it like the jealous one, because we empathize with him, like in an automatic way. On the other hand, a community entails its distance, its lack of feelings. I think. Maybe it's just a second, maybe just a moment, a very fast moment. Then we also empathize. Maybe more and more than with the tragic one. But the first impression of the comic scene when the burst of laughter comes is this taking of distance, according to Bertrand. And I think it's reasonable, it's true.
I think the main first of my question really would be the link between Democritus' laughter and the laughter of the latter in Buddha. We mentioned it maybe a sort of subset of it.
Yeah, I have some problems to imagine the laughing Buddha as emotional. I think that's
maybe to get in the emotional part, but the laughter of the I would say is perhaps a parallel of the laughter of the laughing Buddha.
Yeah, this way
you've got to see it as positive, not the one that you said it completely has in a different way that the laughter of Democritus is to see it.
I think Mike had a question.
Yes,
Katrina. No, Mike then Katrina.
Thank you. That was really wonderful. I really like that. My question was really about the relation between Cossack and Bergson, and that was the part where I slightly lost focus. So maybe you could clear it up. So in Bergson, there is, Lasser is obviously very conservative in a sense. So I don't think, in the sense that he's more so taking the right wing, as opposed to the left wing kind of attitude you're suggesting. So it's conservative in the sense that it restores an exception, or someone behaving in an exceptional way, an unusual way, and restores them to normality. Whereas in Kostic, you're suggesting there's something different. My question is a little bit disordered, but Bergson does not have a way to theorize the ability that we have to laugh at ourselves. You see, what struck me when you were talking, purely anecdotally, is that I do laugh at my own jokes. This is really bad form, but okay, maybe I live alone, whatever. I think it is possible to surprise oneself with a joke, or to just laugh at oneself in a certain way. And I was just wondering what theoretical apparatus you would need to explain that. And I think Bergson doesn't have it, because he doesn't have a proper notion of the unconscious, which takes back to Freud and so on. But this is it. Why is this important? Because the problem is that the only way it's possible to laugh at oneself is if you have a notion of subjectivity that is split, that is divided. And this brings me on to the notion of community in Cossack, because it seems to me that you suggested there that the community can laugh at itself. There was the first quotation you put up, the community can find itself ridiculous. So the first question is really, that doesn't seem to be terribly revolutionary, in fact. But at the same time, there is something important going on here, because it bears on the question of what unifies this community. Because it seems to me you have a very fusional sense of community here, in the sense that you want it to be a solid unified subject again, because that's what you're promoting, really. You're promoting the idea that laughter can form a community that is solidary or something. But if it's capable of laughing at itself, it must be split. And I think, so in other words, and then I think it's split into the superego and the ego, which in a sense is not necessarily terribly liberating, because, you know, the sort of thing to learn in Guattari would say is that you know you're being subordinated by yourself and by your own superego. So I just wanted to see if you find anything in the future.
It's a good point. Yeah, there is this living ambiguity, actually. There is a strong sense of community, in the sense that there is nothing like laughter that gathers together people, but there is always the risk that this laughter can be also a weapon against the community itself. So the possible eventual community of laughter, in this sense, would be something absolutely unstable, in the sense that it continues to build and rebuild, and it always risks to collapse somehow. But on the other hand, this is also a way to overcome another idea of community, which apparently is stronger: the community of love, the community of a nation, the community of thoughts. But in the history, also proved to be very weak, actually. And the history of the last 2 centuries is like the demonstration of this. So I think that the political effort made by Cosi, imagining this communing feature of laughter, could be understood in all its ambiguity, actually. So both in its revolutionary and both in its, in some way, conservative power. And yeah, Bergson doesn't reach this point. He just says as well that there is this social element of laughter. But actually, yeah, I think as well that the problem of his definition, the 3 points that he made, is that if they're quite understandable taken by themselves, it's quite difficult to combine them. I don't know if actually he realizes this contradiction, but that was what I tried to point out. So how can be a laughing subject a part of a community and also apart from the world? That's a total different situation. And I think that the dissident, the political dissident, embodies exactly this figure. So an element that is close enough to community, to feel its problems, its pains, but also always maintaining a sort of outer position. The difficulty is to leave, actually, this very strange, unbalanced, shattering position without falling down, of course. And this is the problem of the dissident, and Kosik, of course, could see it, directly in his experience, from his perspective, absolutely more than the sun.
Katrina?
You touched on the ambivalence of laughter, that it can be an evil laughter way or a humorous way. I don't know if you've considered also the idea that just being different types of laughter that really are quite different, so that Bergson might be right in capturing something about certain instances of laughter being intellectual and involving an emotional distance from the subject, but that there might be other types of laughter that are different. So I think it's something like in Nietzsche, there'd be more than one type of laughter within Nietzsche, is already sort of talking about several types, and you've got the idea of the Overman laughter being really different and joyful laughter.
Nietzsche says der Wahrlacher, the truth laughter, the one who laughs at the truth.
And where there's also joyful laughter, like almost laughing out of joy, whether you could kind of acknowledge that both. Rather kind of reduce laughter to one thing, that they're both types of laughter that are genuinely different.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose would you be interested in kind of there being different types, and there being possible that Bergson is capturing one aspect that isn't emotional, but there could be other emotional types of laughter?
Absolutely. So there's a quantity of, there's a variety of laughter. Is a reason of the ambiguity of this phenomenon, of course.
So,
that's
how you view it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I suppose, historical moment, as you can see, the classic made me think of the film Daisy. Do you know the film?
Which one?
Daisies. I don't know what the name in Czech would be.
Daisies?
Daisies.
Oh yeah, the one by Věra Chytilová.
Yeah,
that's great.
About Lapsik and Larsen, but also politics, whether he was responding, whether Larsen did have a particular role within that particular revolutionary period.
Czechoslovakia during the 60s and 70s, and actually Věra Chytilová, which is the director of the movie you quoted, is maybe the best, with Frank Myers, which is of course more known, but she's also a representative of this movement. So there's a use of laughter as a dissident device, as a dissident tool, absolutely.
So
it
was the culture
and
the
therapy
as well.
Absolutely. And the movie you quoted is a good example. I didn't think of that actually. It's there are two characters in this movie, two girls, who act in a very mechanical way. So this is interesting because again, this idea of a mechanical movement within reality. But their movements are associated to this very strange variety of sounds of and other elements that are totally unrelated to the very action that is happening, and so the effect is of course comic. But this is another example, yes, introducing in reality a sort of variety because of this incapability to melt in the surrounding system, it causes laughter. Yeah.
Sorry?
I'm not sure if my question is similar to your mic, I hope it adds something a little bit different. But so in the beginning of your talk, you describe laughter in almost an ontological sense, about a certain, in terms of a certain withdrawal from the world, taking a certain distance from the world. At the end of your talk, you talk about laughter being constitutive of a certain type of community. And then you talk about how this community of laughter was in a sense rejected in both authoritarian and democratic society. And I started to wonder about what kind of community are we talking about here? And is it in fact a community? Or is it in fact just well, let me phrase it somewhat differently. Is there actually a community that is constituted by laughter? Or is laughter, or does laughter in this context only have dissident power, only have a negative power, a destructive power? So in fact, laughter is only destructive of community. It's not constitutive of community. Now, of course, you can imagine in a certain sense, when you are in a certain type of political situation, there are many people laughing together, and together that has a certain force, that has a force of destruction, has a force of resistance, or a force of dissonance against an established authority. But it's not quite a community either, because it has, I mean, our understanding of community seems to necessitate, well, and that's really part of my question, seems to necessitate a positive element. And so I wonder then, is there a community? And that makes a lot of sense when you understand why democratic society would also reject this idea of laughter and say, no, this is in fact part of the theory of the times because you're in fact trying to constitute something here. And laughter really only has a destructive.
That's actually the dilemma of dissidents. So can dissidents be not just a negative force, a force of opposition, a force of laughing as well, but on the same basis constitute also something positive beyond this negative element? This is a question that actually many dissidents had to ask, because it happened to them to find themselves in a situation in which they also have to build a new state. But the case of Czechoslovakia is perfect. The dissident becomes president from one day to another. So anyway, it depends, to answer your question, it depends what you mean by community, I think. So this is not, of course, what normally is meant by this term, but if community is that situation, state in which a number of people gather together for some reason, and this movement, this aggregating new movement, somehow lasts also beyond the mere negative burst of laughter. Yeah, I think in that case, also in this case, also in laughing, the original community can be affected. Is it possible? That's the question, of course. But according to Kozica, it's not only possible, but it's necessary, because the great effort of forthcoming politics is to imagine a totally new kind of political union, which is not based only on political elements like the ones I mentioned before, not only on force, on political power, on political effectivity, but also on elements that reveal the weakness of community itself, the weakness of people. So can a negative element which characterizes a certain number of people become also a positive element in view of the development of a new kind of community? This is a good point. Also Jan Patočka, for example, tried to say the same exact thing.
So, but my question is, is there a contradiction, or is there a tension between this idea of withdrawal and indifference? Can you have a community of those subjects who have withdrawn and they have become
withdrawn? They are not totally withdrawn, that's the part. This is the contradiction. So, there is an Italian philosopher, Cristina Campo, who wrote interesting works. I don't know if they are translated or not. Anyway, she coined this word to define this a position quite similar to the one we are thinking at. And the word is the unforgivable. Who is unforgivable in society? Unforgivable is a person who is too much close to reality to just ignore it, to just give up the problem, but who in the same time is also too far from the daily life, the common life, to consider himself something just apart from it. So the difficulty of this position, not too close to reality, not too far from reality, is this. So it's something that cannot just be excluded from the community, but neither easily included. And this is the position of the thinker in general, I think. But it is a problematic political position, because it's something that politics cannot accept at all.
I wanted to come back, but I won't come back because I'll talk to you afterwards. But I think there are two people. Matt, did you have your hand up? Jagan does, but I see it. But did you have your hand up, Matt?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Okay, let's have the last two, and then we'll allow Francesco to go and make a revolution outside with laughter. So who's going first? Jagan?
Yeah,
Matt?
Yeah, I was trying to. My theory is how things like the Bible and the theory how
maybe it's comedy that tries to recuperate more democracy.
One more, Jagan. Matt, carry on afterwards. I'm sure Francesca's not going to vanish into thin air. Jagan?
way in which that dynamics are powered, if I'm talking, well, not the mechanism, but some of the related elements, how strong is the mechanism? What do you think?
I think that, that's the very beginning of my talk, actually. So, and that's also the revelation of the ambiguity of the phenomenon of laughter. So, at the same realization, so the observer can both cause laughing and crying. Yeah, that's the starting point. I think that the relation is very strong in the sense that laughter is a sort of answer to the world in itself. So there is no laughter without a subject of laugh and a world, a situation which must have some element of absurdity that is laughed at. So I think that in some way the origin of laughter is the same origin of love, you can say. That, the very experience of what appears in all its hardness and complexity, yes, or absurdity, can be closed. Yeah, I don't know actually the tension, what this tension can cause. So maybe it's a theme, it's a topic that should be actually developed further, of course. But the image of the two philosophers that look at the world from this outer, unnatural, totally impossible perspective, just one of the philosophers, of course. And the laugh or cry, it's the demonstration of the total absurdity itself. But it's a point that actually we should discuss further. Not just relating to laughter, but also to other themes that absurdity can cause, of course. Laughter is just one, this human phenomenon.
I think, Dario, we should probably... Would you like to thank Francesco, Dario, or shall I thank Francesco? Or shall we all thank Francesco?
Thank you, Francesco.
There'll be, now we'll go to the bar, and carry on. Francesco.
Yeah.
You know,
and you're not thinking about that, you're thinking about
I'll take it for him and he can...